Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Here are some interesting articles from the October issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Crazy fun in Canyon Country. In pursuit of "What the hell have you gotten me into?" moments in Utah. By Matt Crossman. We looked over the edge into the depths of the earth, a black abyss with apparently no light, no walls, and no bottom. And yet it was into that lightless, wallless, bottomless hole we intended to go. The fact that we planned to rappel into this particular hole in the ground with a guide who had done it before suggested very, very strongly that there were, in fact, light and walls and a bottom. But as John and Patricia, married adventurous from Colorado, and I peered into the Goblin's Lair, a canyon in Utah's Goblin Valley State Park, we could see none of that. We had to take guide Christopher Hagedorn's word for it that the ground was down there, 90 feet below us. I asked Patricia, a flight attendant and amateur pilot, what her anxiety level was. She said it was 3 now, would jump to 7 when she got to the edge, and to 10 when she went over. I liked that she said when, not if. Of the hundreds of customers Hagedorn, owner of the Get in the Wild Adventures, had guided on rappelling trips, only 3 have looked into a lightless, wallless, bottomless abyss and left without entering. Patricia did not want to be the 4th. But she didn't want to take any steps toward the edge either. "She's still smiling. That's good," Hagedorn said. "You don't want to know what I'm thinking," she said. "I better not look or I won't go." Hagedorn tightened Patricia's harness and checked and rechecked the ropes. She peeked toward the hole, big enough for a person to fit through, too small for, say, an elephant, but not into it. John had already rappelled and was down there somewhere. She sighed. It was now or never, and she was choosing now, or trying to at least. "What the hell have you gotten me into?" she shouted down to John. I spent a week touring southern Utah in pursuit of "What the hell have you gotten me into?" moments. I found them going fast and slow on sand dunes and rocky cliffs, deep inside canyons and far out on desert plains. I found all of them outside of Utah's 5 national parks, which have become so crowded that the state's tourism boosters now encourage travelers to explore the rest of the Beehive State. In Moab, my heart rate quickened just reading the description of Moab Cowboy Country's OHV Sunset Tour. If you have a fear of heights, this night might not be the tour for you. Me? I'm not afraid of heights, but I am afraid of falling from very steep climbs and descents or a twisting, turning trail. Hell's Revenge has very steep climbs and descents and has a twisting, turning trail. Me. Uh-oh. I climbed into an off-highway vehicle in Cowboy Country's parking lot in downtown Moab. Owner Kent Green offered a wry smile, the kind of smile I see often from adventure guides, the kind of smile that worries me, and said the first hill would get me warmed up. When I arrived at Hell's Revenge and looked up the first hill, well, I tried not to. It looked like a giant hippo lying on its side, slick, steep, and high. The path going up it was not terribly wide. If I accelerated too much, I would be in trouble. If I didn't accelerate enough, I would be in trouble. If I missteered 10 feet right or left, I would be in trouble. I was grateful to be 3rd in a line of 4 because that allowed me to follow exactly where the 2 ahead of me went And also, it effectively prevented me from chickening out because there was someone behind me. Kent Green was right. That first hill warmed me up. Sweat slickened my palms and soaked my back. After 20 minutes of driving through rocky creek beds, over boulders, and into and out of ravines, we stopped for a break near Abyss Canyon. You're catching on to the names here, right? I had not reached even 10 miles per hour, and yet I felt like I'd done a full-body workout. The left side of my left leg hurt. I'd been pressing it into the side of the OHV as if it would stop it from tipping over. At least my nerves were well-placed. When Cricket Green, Kent's wife, started leading tours, she wore gloves to hide her white knuckles as she piloted the OHV. On this crisp evening, she looked back often to make sure we were all still there and our OHVs were upright. She offered a bromide her dad taught her. God forgives, but the rocks don't, and it's a long way to the hospital. As careful as Cricket was, it was still a crazy ride, even at a max speed of 10 miles per hour. "We scare the hell out of you and still keep you safe," she said. As we zipped atop the sand in our ATVs at Coral Pink Sand Dunes State Park, Gordon Baxter noticed strange markings on the ground, footprints with a line between them. After stopping to inspect them, Baxter realized they were prints from a Gila monster, the largest land lizard in the United States. Gila monsters are venomous and extremely rare. Baxter, owner of Coral Pink ATV Tours, followed the trail on foot. Following the tracks of a dangerous animal is a very Utah thing to do, so I fell in line behind him. Up and over sand dunes we went, dodging cacti that wanted to spear us. Along the way, we crossed tracks left by a rattlesnake and a coyote. I wasn't sure which of the three I wanted to find least, the venomous snake, the venomous lizard, or the carnivorous predator. Alas, we never found any of them. We climbed back on our ATVs and sped through a whoop trail. They strayed away with bumps big enough to be fun, but not so big I couldn't speed over them. The crisp blue sky contrasted against the bright yellow and made the tops of the dunes look like razor's edges. Stealing a joke several guides have told me, I said to Baxter, "You have a beautiful office." It's enormous, too. Almost 2,000 acres at Coral Pink Sand Dunes State Park are open to ATVs and gets redecorated hour by hour. Wind whipping through a notch between the Moquith and Moccasin Mountains erodes the sandstone and carries grains to the dunes. That's been going on for 10,000 to 15,000 years, and the dunes are endlessly reshaped like mashed potatoes under a child's spoon. Baxter handed a sandboard to me atop a dune. I pushed my bare feet into the bindings and slid downhill. The sand was as soft as it was warm, which I discovered by wiping out frequently. When I finally made it to the bottom, upright, I raised my hands in triumph. I was sweaty and smiling and covered in sand. "You're wearing your good time," Baxter said. Which brings me back to the goblin's lair. Patricia was wearing her fear on her face and in her body language, but she was not giving in to it. "It's a 10 now, if you're wondering," she said. She inched toward the opening in the earth anyway. "You're doing great," Hagedorn said. She exhaled. "I can do this," Patricia said. "I got you," Hagedorn said. "I know you do," she said. She backed up, reached the edge. One more step and she'd have no choice but to keep going, and took that last step. The taut rope kept her from tumbling backward. She pushed her feet against the canyon wall, her legs parallel to the ground, 90 feet below her. "Holy shit," she said. That was the last thing she said before she disappeared into the canyon. It reminded me of a story Hagedorn told. In addition to the three customers who left without rappelling, a fourth was tied in for 45 minutes before she finally went over the edge. And even that was more due to a clever bit of gamesmanship on Hagedorn's part than on her own courage. I'm going to keep that gamesmanship a secret in case Hagedorn ever has to use it again. Regardless, when that woman finally went over the edge, she let loose a string of expletives that would make a truck driver blush. Patricia's lone bad word broke a dam of tension. Her anxiety flowed away and was replaced by exuberance. Wow! This is crazy! Whoa! The air was 10 degrees cooler in the cavern than it was at the top. Her voice echoed off the canyon walls as she slowly descended. The wall she had been bracing her feet on now moved away from her like a chin receding into a neck, so she was in the free rappel portion of the descent. She stopped for a few seconds to look around. She twisted her hips to spin her body to give herself a 360-degree view of what looked like the lobby of a grand hotel fashioned of sandstone. She coasted down more. Ha ha ha! Woo-hoo! Awesome! Her husband yelled up. Woo-hoo! She said as she touched the ground 90 feet below the entrance. Above her, light filled the hole she had just come through. From the canyon floor, the sky looked white, wallless, and infinite. Trail Guide to Utah's Canyon Country. Here are some accommodations, restaurants, and adventures that don't have the "what the hell have you gotten me into" moments, but are worthwhile nonetheless. Stay at the Perry Lodge in Kanab. Kanab in general, and Perry Lodge in particular, celebrate the area's history with the movie industry. Loads of westerns were made here. Every room at Perry Lodge is named after a Hollywood personality, and the walls in the restaurant and lobby are covered with photos of big names who have stayed there. Or stay at the Escalante Yurts in Escalante. Do as the website advises and surround yourself with peace and solitude and nature nestled in the trees and hollows of beautiful red rock country in southern Utah. This camp of cozy yurts is located along Utah's scenic Byway 12 and sits inside 20 secluded acres. Sit on the deck to watch the sunset and get up early to watch it rise. Eat at the North Creek Grill in Escalante. The restaurant, part of the Slot Canyon's Inn, prides itself on serving its own grass-fed beef, raised on the Rex Ranch, and locally sourced ingredients. I follow a policy of ordering items if I've never seen them on a menu before, which is why I fully endorse the polenta fries. Or eat at the Rocking V Cafe in Kanab. This restaurant in quaint downtown Kanab was rocking all right. There was barely a seat available when I went in on a Sunday night in June. Can't miss item on the menu, tomato basil soup. Canyoneering is a relatively new sport in the United States and is sometimes confused with rappelling. Rappelling is the act of descending via ropes. Canyoneering is everything you can do in a canyon, including but not limited to hiking, swimming, wading, crawling, and yes, rappelling. What to do? Angel's Palace Trail, Kodachrome Basin State Park. I spent 10 days absorbed by Utah's unending scenic beauty. I rafted, hiked, and drove through canyons, deserts, and mountains. If you forced me to pick the prettiest place, it would be Angel's Palace Trail. You'll find it outside the town of Cannonville and just miles from another gym, Bryce Canyon National Park. The Trail of Sleeping Rainbows, Escalante Petrified Forest State Park. remains from petrified trees that dot the landscape in this park outside of Escalante are more than 100 million years old. Some of the logs along the trail are no longer round. They have flattened out as if they gave in long ago to the unbearable weight of time. And finally, Peekaboo Slot Canyon Tour, Forever Adventure Tours. You might feel like you're in a western when you explore the landscapes around Kanab. That's because these backdrops have starred in dozens of westerns filmed here. Everything from The Big Trail with the Duke in 1930 to The Outlaw Josie Wales with Clint in 1976. Highlights of this tour: walking through a canyon in which you can touch walls on both sides with your hands at the same time, an ancient greenery, and a lake or slash pond in a cave. Cuatro Tequilas y Mezcales Fantásticos del Oeste and one Studley Soto from Texas. It's a good thing the West carries on south of the border, because there's no excluding our favorite blue agave-derived spirit, tequila, and its more broadly defined hermano, mezcal, made from numerous types of agave, in this happy mix. Both are strictly produced in designated regions of Mexico, primarily the west central state of Jalisco, tequila's prime production hub, and deep southwest Oaxaca, mezcal-making central. North of the border, America has swiftly become the world's biggest market for tequila, according to the International Wines and Spirits Record, with hip, smoky mezcal seeing an astounding 32% national consumption bump in recent years. Translation: Cuervo and Patron don't even scratch the surface. Here's an extra pair of tequilas and mezcals worth knowing, and one stateside Sotol for good measure. Salud. La Cholula de Matamoros, Oaxaca, Mexico. Regal Mezcal Reposado. A sippable, approachable mezcal, this uniquely prepared reposado is aged for 4 months in bourbon barrels, lending it a woodiness and velvety mouthfeel with hints of bitter orange, toffee, and clove that whiskey fans should particularly appreciate. Produced at the century-old Distilleria La Cholula, one of Oaxaca's most revered traditional mezcal distilleries, illegal mezcal naturally raises the question, what's behind the name? As the story goes, the brand's American expat founder, John Rexer, started his business as a pet project after illegally sneaking Oaxacan mezcal over the border to keep his Guatemala bar, Café Noce, well supplied for a rapidly growing demand. Nowadays, it's all done by the book. $60.99, illegalmezcal.com. Tequila, Jalisco, Mexico. Tequila Casa Dragones, Hoven. Co-founded just a decade ago by First Lady of Tequila, Bertha Gonzalez Nieves, Mexico's first female maestra tequilera, master tequila distiller, Casa Dragones has forged its own savory corner of the high-end tequila market with awards and accolades that jibe with its focus on craft, purity, and controlled, small-batch, hand-signed, and numbered bottles. For a relative bargain in this bracket, start with the Blanco, $75, a crisp, subtly sweet, but peppery experience that stands well on its own. When you're ready, advance to the heralded Hoven, a supremely smooth blend of silver and extra-aged tequila, which Travel and Leisure said is quite likely the best-sipping tequila made, and Oprah ordained one of her favorite things. For private tastings, dedicated tequila tourists can head to the historic town of San Miguel de Allende to visit the producer's Tony Tasting headquarters, housed in the converted stables of a 17th century cavalry battalion. $285, CasaDragones.com. Jesus Maria, Jalisco, Mexico. Tequila Clase Azul Reposado. Dwarfing its Casamigos, Herradura and Juan Julio cousins like a Guadalajara steeple. Clase Azul's handmade, individually painted 15-inch tall ceramic decanter, capped with an actual bell, is one holy-looking bit of top-shelf architecture. All righteous packaging aside, it's what's happening inside that counts. The premium brand's famously smooth tequila foursome ranges from an unaged Plata and a 2-year-old Añejo to an extra Añejo aged for 5 years in sherry wood with limited releases in platinum, silver, and gold embroidered receptacles, starting at around $1,600. For our time and money, we'll opt for the sufficiently rested Reposado, a zero-burn, oak-barrel-aged, perfect sipper that's been described by tequila evaluators as having complex aromas of earthy agave, spice, caramel, and, wait for it, cream soda. $115, ClaseAzul.com. Santiago Matalan, Osaka, Mexico. Montelobos Mezcal Joven. Jumping from tequila to its smoky kin spirit Mezcal can be painful if you're not careful. Start too hard and it's like staring down a campfire in the wind. Here's that young, light, sweet, subtle enough Mezcal, packing just the right amount of earthy oomph to safely ease the palate into your next big, fiery agave spirit experience without engulfing it. Produced from organic Oaxacan espadine agave, roasted for up to a week in a traditional stone pit, this artisan mezcal strives to avoid what company founder Dr. Ivan Saldaña, who has authored a book on the subject, The Anatomy of Mezcal, calls inopportune proportions. Concentrating equally on mezcal's sweeter, citrusy notes alongside the requisite smoke, the result is an easy one to enjoy on the rocks. $38, Montelobos.com. Driftwood, Texas. Desert Door, Texas, Sotol, original. Sotol. It might not have the same ring as its spotlight-hogging, once-removed cousin, tequila, but that just makes this freewheeling northern Mexico-derived spirit, produced from a flowering desert plant, also abundant across the American Southwest, all the more intriguing and legal to produce in the United States. That's good news for audacious domestic distillers and swillers open to discovering a traditional spirit, reminiscent of a desert gin crossed with a smooth sipping tequila, note the founders of Desert Door, a trio of Texas-based military veterans and University of Texas Biz school grads determined to put Sotol on the map, one deep blue bottle at a time. made from wild harvested West Texas sotol, in accordance with the traditional spirits ancient Chihuahuan Desert native producers. The goods are cooked in steam and fermented with organic yeast before modernity, a custom-built copper still, plays its hand. The final product is described by its makers as finishing with minerality and a welcome eucalyptus quality that will make you wonder why you haven't met before and have you dreaming of your next encounter. $40, DesertDoor.com. Four bold beers of the West and one scrumptious cider. Back in American beer's medieval period, the late 1970s, fewer than 90 breweries owned by just 42 companies were producing mainly run-of-the-mill suds to an oblivious but parched nation. Only the most clairvoyant beer geeks would have predicted today's craft hyper-renaissance, which has resulted in more than 7,000 breweries from coast to coast, 150 in Denver alone, and about 98% of them small, independent craft brewers obsessed with turning a once dull national beer industry into a hopped-up landscape of world-renowned ales of all shades and overachieving lagers now treated with the deference of fine wines. What makes the American West such a force in today's beer brigade? There's the Terror itself, home to some of the world's top barley and hops fields. There are all those beer festivals. Check out Portland's roster alone. And there's the sheer volume. Just three western states, California, Colorado, and Washington, are home to nearly a third of America's craft breweries. Trying to single out four great western brews and a single cider from all the legendary ones that this half of the country consistently puts out is sheer agony. But we did it. Here we raise a frosty pint to five standouts in five great brewing states, while gratefully tipping our hat to all of those other game changers that helped get us here. Hey, Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, Anchor Steam, Odell IPA, Russian River Pliny the Elder, Weldworks Coffee Maple Achromatic Imperial Double Stout, etc., etc. This bud's for you. The Idaho IPA, Grand Teton Brewing Teton Range IPA. Once upon a time, in 1988, Grand Teton Brewing garnered instant Western beer cred by becoming Wyoming's first modern craft brewery. Hopping across Teton Pass a decade later, the award-winning ale maker is now Idaho's oldest brewery, and as rock solid as any beer company branding itself after its neighboring mountain range needs to be. Homegrown grains and hops, as well as naturally filtered Teton glacial runoff, surfacing from a spring half a mile from the brewery, are a few of the secrets behind Grand Teton's crisp and fruity flagship IPA, with just a hint of pine and merciful restraint on the palate-clobbering bitterness. Hefty enough to be ranked among the top 50 IPAs in the nation by Draft magazine, it's also tender enough for the same graders to liken the beer's nose to a basket of fruits and flowers, and a hint of pixie sticks. For hardcore hopheads, Grand Teton's seasonal IPA, Hopplexity, features revolving hop combinations for each release, and its double IPA, Lost Continent, uses a whopping 6 different strains. GrandTetonBrewing.com. The Oregon Porter. Deschutes Brewery Black Butte. When you're the flagship beer of an A-list craft institution like Deschutes Brewery, sporting a lineup of all-star ales, Mirror Pond, Bachelor Bitter, Fresh Squeezed IPA, Obsidian Stout, The Abyss, Red Chair NWPA, the list goes on. That's been consistently blowing beer buffs' minds for more than 3 decades. That's saying something. Back in the late 80s, when this Bend, Oregon institution was a little brew pub with a crazy dream in a small town by a wild river, the Deschutes, hence the name, there weren't many porters floating around this side of the Atlantic, and even fewer good ones. No longer the dark horse, but still plenty dark, rich, creamy, and layered with definitive tones of coffee and chocolate, Black Butte is the second highest rated of more than 7,000 American porters now swamping the Beer Advocate database. That's saying something, too. DeschutesBrewery.com. The Washington Lager. Chuckanut Brewery Pilsner Lager. Attention, lager drinkers. There's far more to the world's most popular beer species than what often meets the koozie. Take the ones meticulously crafted at Chuckanut Brewery. During its dozen years, the small Bellingham-based gem has wowed savvy clientele and distinguished beer judges with some of the most game-raising lagers between coastal Washington and Bavaria. A gold medalist in the 2018 Beer World Cup, Chuckanut's signature European-style cold-fermented pilsner is described by the brewer as floral, snappy, and mouth-watering. And it pairs perfectly with a Reuben sandwich or bowl of steamer clams soaked in savory beer broth. As luck would have it, Chuckanut serves those things as well. Chuckanut Brewery and Kitchen.com. The Arizona Ale, Four Peaks Brewing Company. Kill Lifter. Furnished with over 100 craft breweries, Arizona knows a thing or two about beer, and not just poolside pilsners in July. The flagship medal winner from Tempe's biggest craft brewer distributor, Four Peaks Brewing Company, is this full-bodied Scottish-style ale brimming with flavors of caramel and roasted barley. Housed in a historic Mission Revival-style brick building that did time as an ice factory, creamery, and recording studio, Four Peaks 8th Street headquarters in Tempe is open for brew tours and lunch, and no airs about its recent World Conquest partnership with Anheuser-Busch. For calorie counters, there's Guilt Lifter, half the cows and carbs with all that Gaelic-flavored goodness. FourPeaks.com. The Montana Cider. Last Chance Cider Mill Perfection. Founded in 2016, Billings-based Last Chance Cider Mill has already gained a reputation for producing some of the top small-batch ciders in the West. Employing Montana and Oregon apples, okay, and some Michigan ones, it's the first cider maker in the state to grind and press its own apples instead of relying on commercial juices or concentrates. The tasty results include a recent gold medal at the North American Beer Awards for its Perfection cider, moderately sweetened with Oregon pear juice. For some extra tart, try the Flathead Cherry, which won the silver, along with Last Chance's semi-sweet signature cider, Orchard Run. About 20 tons of apples are pressed weekly at the mill, and we know you're wondering where all that leftover apple pomace goes. To a local farmer for his cattle. Last Chance is that kind of a place. LastChanceCider.com. With a little help from best friends. Save them all is the ambitious mission of the hardworking and heartwarming Best Friends Animal Society and Sanctuary in Kanab, Utah. By Leah Roberts. From a base padded with pinon and juniper, the Vermilion Cliffs rise in blushed sandstone glory, wrapping protectively around Kanab, Utah's hidden treasure, Best Friends Animal Sanctuary. The mountainous scarlet landscape fills the eyes and hearts with inspiration. So, too, the kindness and dedication of the people who power the nonprofit Best Friends Animal Society and care for its pets at this home between homes. The dream of Best Friends Animal Society came to life in 1984, when a group of founders banded together in hopes of ending the killing of more than 17 million animals a year in the nation's shelters. They made the bold decision to purchase 3,000 acres of land in the ancient, petrified sand dunes of the Vermilion Cliffs, and with only $5,000 down, began building the first facilities of their animal safe haven from the ground up with their own hands. Today, in addition to the sanctuary, there are 4 Best Friends life-saving centers spread throughout the United States, from Los Angeles to New York City to Atlanta, as well as its programs in Houston and Northwest Arkansas. Along with nearly 3,000 other animal welfare groups within its network. Thanks largely to the work of Best Friends and its allies, that 17 million has been reduced by more than 16 million to 733,000. The mission to save them all guides the ultimate goal of ending the killing of pets in shelters across the country by 2025. More than 1,600 homeless animals, most from Best Friends Network partners across the country, live at the Best Friends Animal Sanctuary at any given time, housed happily across 3,700 acres of land in sections like Dogtown, Cat World, Horse Haven, Piggy Paradise, Bunny House, Parrot Garden, and Wild Friends, for as long as it takes them to find loving homes for them. For animals who've crossed the Rainbow Bridge, there's Angel's Rest on the grounds. And for those who need the checkups, vaccinations, and other vet care, there's a clinic. For human visitors, some 38,000 in 2019, there's a welcome center. And now there's a new phenomenal place to stay. To support the droves of animal lovers who come to see the operation and the animals and often stay to volunteer, Best Friends recently added accommodations, a cafe, and a store to its animal kingdom. Revamping a 70s motel, they opened the brand new and, of course, uber pet-friendly 40-room mid-century modern Roadhouse and Mercantile, 5 miles from the sanctuary property in the heart of downtown Kanab. Also known as Little Hollywood for the many westerns filmed here, Kanab takes pride in being the perfect base camp for adventure, owing to 5 national monuments, 2 state parks, 2 national forests, 3 national parks, and 1 of the largest national recreation areas in the country. A visit to Best Friends is an altogether different kind of Kanab adventure, One of the society's guiding principles is the golden rule, to treat all living things as we ourselves would wish to be treated. The philosophy certainly translates to the great guest experience as its stunning new hotel. Designed by W.O.W. Atelier Architects of Salt Lake City and Jillian Kluwer, and a clad of lots of handcrafted alder wood, the Best Friends Roadhouse and Mercantile inhabit five simple, low-slung, high-design structures, which blend unobtrusively with the rosy canyon country landscape. In the roadhouse, the well-thought-out rooms fall comfortably on the luxurious, inviting continuum for people and their pets. From the charming two-door entry, perfect for ensuring your pet won't slip out, to the room furnishings built 18 inches or higher to avoid pet entrapment, and finally to the cruelty-free bathroom amenities, no detail has been overlooked. Down to the welcoming lobby made cozy by a crackling fireplace and a continuous supply of complimentary vegan cookies, pet mural created by artisan Benjamin Weimeyer of Salt Lake City, adorning the entire back wall of the roadhouse, and in the courtyard, the immense bronze of a dog created and donated by sculptor Dale Rogers of Chicago. Each room was named for a beloved Best Friends animal alum and decorated with gallery-style photos of an adopted pet. Above my headboard peered the eager face of an adorable shepherd named Tobin. Under comfy, immaculately made beds, there were smartly designed pet-sized versions to be pulled out like miniature trundle beds. Two dog bowls sat at the ready. Behind the roadhouse, two fenced-in play areas, one for small dogs and one for big, receive canine frolickers. Next door at the mercantile, photo profiles of adopted animals lined the walls. Between reading those and shopping for Best Friends merchandise, you could spend many contented hours. Naturally, everything at the Best Friends Roadhouse and Mercantile, from the dog and cat treats to the complimentary continental breakfasts for guests, is cruelty and animal product free. As impressive and inviting as the accommodations are, and as caring and capable as the hospitality is, it's the work Best Friends does on behalf of animals that provides the true attraction and soul of the place. One of the founders, Cyrus Mejia, played gracious host to my group, chauffeuring us through the sanctuary in one of the tour vans named after the 22 dogs Best Friends rescued from Michael Vick. Best Friends also was the first animal fair rescue group on the scene and last to leave when Katrina struck in 2005 and spent more than 9 months in New Orleans, saving approximately 6,000 animals. Mejia introduced us to some of the rowdy 150-pound potbellies enjoying life at the Piggy Paradise, and shuttled us to the vast Angel's Landing Amphitheater that overlooked a canyon made familiar to generations of Americans by the many episodes of The Lone Ranger TV series with Clayton Moore and Jay Silverheels filmed there. At the Angel's Rest Pet Cemetery, where 8,000-plus animals have been laid to rest, we fell quietly into our own memories of pets we've loved and lost. But joy returned easily when we stopped by the puppy preschool to get in some cuddle time with the newly adoptable Chala and other squirming balls of fur. I spent an afternoon sprucing up at the bunny house and falling in love with new arrival Hope, who was too shy to even let me pet her, but eventually, and reluctantly, ate banana chips and lettuce from my hand. Hanging out with the bunny crew, I learned the facts I'd never known. Did you know, for instance, that bunnies can have litters of 4 to 12 babies every 30 days and can become pregnant again as soon as one day after giving birth? The bulk of my volunteering time found me at the Old Friends Dog Facility. There, I was taken not only with the animals, but also with their reticent caretaker, Tim. Every person interacts with animals differently. Some squeal with excitement. Others speak in a baby voice, guilty. And some are content to communicate silently. As I learned from Tim, words do not always convey the love and compassion a person can hold in their heart. A quiet man, he moved swiftly among the different dog kennels, making sure all the animals were thoroughly cared for, as our group of volunteers took his guidance and helped wherever we could in his wake. Most of the dogs were bouncing with excitement for dinner time, but Kit and Caboodle were not. These two neurologically disabled sisters lay on their sides, squirming and flopping around uncontrollably like fish out of water, their legs ramrod straight, their feet unnaturally pointed every which way. They floundered in excitement as Tim came with their dinner, gently tucking each of them into a pillow-padded corner, soothing each of them as he spread out their kibble. Not a word was said, and it didn't need to be. I was overwhelmed with emotion. But don't feel bad for Kit and Caboodle. They are very loved and well cared for. Because when best friend says, "Save them all," they mean it. And as everyone who loves and cares for animals knows, the salvation and best friendship go both ways. Want to be a best friend? For more information on visiting, volunteering, adopting, and donating, visit bestfriends.org. Find out more about KNAB Utah at cowboysindians.com. A Pinto Milestone by Lindsay Weckel. Enter through the doors of any Pinto Ranch store, and the scent of fine leather will immediately overtake your senses. Your eyes will quickly catch up to your nose in awe of an impressive wall lined with handmade boots and fashion pieces. Cap this off with a friendly greeting by a knowledgeable sales associate, and you're on your way to experiencing what this 15-year-old Western business endeavors to embody: the grandeur, quality, and kindness of the American West. Pinto Ranch began as a vision of Walter Pye, Jr., a man whose retail roots run deep. From 1934 to 1997, his eponymous family retail shop was long associated with fine attire. But it was Pinto Ranch that brought Pye back onto the fashion scene. In 2004, Pinto Ranch opened its 13,000-square-foot flagship store in Houston. Named after a real working ranch in Wyoming, the store has since expanded to locations in Dallas and Las Vegas, as well as an airport location in Houston. It's an idea of the traditions and the legacy of the West, the pioneering spirit, that American style that is all our own, says B. Garcia, Pinto Ranch marketing director, of the inspiration behind the store. Inside its walls, visitors will find a vast but carefully curated collection of goods. From handmade boots, 14-karat gold buckles, finely crafted silver jewelry, one-of-a-kind saddles, and high-fashion apparel that blends ranch with runway. Here, the Western world is your oyster. The store offers an unexpected shopping experience to customers who might expect something more stereotypical, Garcia says. At Pinto Ranch, it is about pairing high-end apparel with authentic statement pieces for the Western lifestyle. And the modern-day trend of Western influences, found anywhere from Hollywood to New York City, inspires the business. People are blending fashions more, Garcia says.
It's not such a vertical, strict styling that it used to be. We offer unique stylings that can fit with anything because it's truly American. I think people are open to doing something new and being individual in their fashion, which is nice because this means that we can continue to grow and expand what we have to offer, and that people will find us just as interesting and unique as they want to be. Customers can also revel in Pinto Ranch's brick-and-mortar locations. We love having visitors, Garcia says. Houston, Las Vegas, and Dallas couldn't represent us better than they do, because they're just iconic cities of the West. It's a great trio of representation for us, and we hope to move forward in those cities forever and be accessible to our customers. Part of being accessible means Pinto Ranch has embraced the online retail atmosphere with its trademark focus on customer service. Never fear, long-distance shoppers. Pinto Ranch prioritizes providing customers with the knowledge of sales associates who have decades-long histories in Western fashion. And if a customer needs to exchange a pair of boots, the brand is quick to offer free shipping until the buyer finds the perfect fit. Speaking of boots, Pinto Ranch prides itself on offering one of the largest selections of traditionally handmade boots in the country. This fall, Garcia says, they've outdone themselves. Our boots are the tried and true way of making boots that dates back over 150 years. So that's definitely a legacy that we're proud to continue. We're so excited about the boots in this fall and winter. Our boot buyer, Mike Burchette, has really done an outstanding job. You're not going to get a better boot anywhere. The Baritone Breakout. Kane Brown endured early struggles, but found massive success. When Kane Brown was growing up, all he wanted to do was fit in. Now, all he wants to do is stand out. And maybe that's why everything he's doing in country music right now is working out so well. Because even at just 25, Brown knows where he stands. Brown tells Cowboys and Indians about his unlikely path to Nashville and into the studio with Brooks and Dunn. Long before he was a bona fide country star, Brown was immersed in the music because of his mom. It was like an escape for me and my mom. We had a lot of pressure on us, and it was a bond for us, Brown says. My bedtime stories would be me and my mom singing together. Shania Twain, Sugarland, the Dixie Chicks. That music's been in my life ever since. During those early years, back when bullying was often overlooked, Brown suffered through countless taunts about how different he was. All the kids had money, and we didn't, he recalls. I had Old Navy clothes that didn't really fit, and the only football cleats we could afford were three sizes too big, so I was tripping over them all the time. I didn't fit in at all. Eventually, he outgrew that reputation, but by then, it was almost too late to learn to socialize. I wasn't used to talking to people. I stuck to myself. I was kind of weird. I used to always want to fit in, but now it's like I want to be an outcast. I want to stand out. I want to create my own lane. What Brown did with his alone time is where his lane began. He started singing well-loved country songs for homemade iPhone Facebook videos and quickly amassed a loyal following. So he made more and more. Eventually, he turned his social media fame into the real-life kind when he released his Closer EP, and it climbed all the country charts almost 2 years before he even signed his record deal. And somewhere between his major label self-titled debut album and his follow-up, Experiment, Brooks and Dunn discovered Brown and asked him to be a part of Reboot. Brooks and Dunn's ballad Believe came out in 2005 when Brown was only 12, but it was his grandfather's favorite song, so he knew it well. When he passed away, I'd listen to that song and I'd always tear up, he says. But still, when I asked if I could pick that song, everybody was a little bit nervous. We did it together in the studio, so that was super terrifying. It was the first time I'd ever met Ronnie Dunn, and then I was singing across from him in a studio. But he just coached me through it. I mean, he's got one of the best voices in country music, ever. That really broke me out of my shell. On the new version of the song, Brown's and Dunn's rich baritone voices are so similar that it's hard to hear where one stops and the other begins. But beyond the vocal tour de force, what Brown loves about Believe is exactly what he loves about that whole era of country, the storytelling. It was just unreal, Brown says. Like Craig Morgan's Almost Home, Randy Travis's Three Wooden Crosses. Those songs have to take months to write because you really are writing a story. I've always wanted to write a song like that. Like when it hits you, it really hits you. Here came Brown's latest single, Like a Rodeo, and find out where to see him live by visiting lanebrownmusic.com. The Heartache Kid. John Pardee's laid-back style and devotion to tradition are reeling in the fans. Technically, John Pardee never finished college, but he learned a valuable lesson when he was at California's Butte College. He needed to move to Nashville. I tried college for a while, but I started a country band when I was there called Northern Comfort. We were good, and we had a following, Pardee tells CNI. That was such a learning time for me. I realized the band wasn't going to go anywhere, but I knew I had to if I wanted to do this professionally. So he worked. He saved. And on February 23, 2008, when he was 22, Pardee moved to Tennessee. But you don't just waltz into Music Row and start selling out arenas. And looking back on that, Pardee, 34, says he wouldn't have it any other way. He lifeguarded for a while, did other odd jobs, and started writing song after song after song. Always the kind that stayed true to the roots of traditional country. That's what country is supposed to sound like, he says. It's supposed to have fiddle and steel. That was country to me. I wanted to do what my heroes did, so I just stuck with it. Initially, it took fans a while to connect. There was one Dallas show Pardee played where only 5 people showed up. I'll never forget that, he says. You can't get mad about it, though. You just have to try to figure it out. It keeps you humble. What matters to Pardee now, he said, is that when guys like Ronnie Dunn and Kix Brooks shake your hand, you feel like one of the boys. It's a mutual adoration club Pardee's honored to be a part of. The first time Pardee remembers feeling the full impact of Brooks and Dunn's music was around 2007, when they were touring with Alan Jackson and made a California stop. I remember hearing them sing Hillbilly Deluxe and thinking, damn, that is such a badass honky-tonk song. But the song Pardee sings on Reboot is much, much older. It's from 1991, off their debut album Brand New Man, released when Pardee was only 6. It's called My Next Broken Heart. I wanted one of them old-school honky-tonk jams, with that shuffle vibe, he says. And when it came time to record, Pardee was ready. I'd been practicing, and Ronnie and said he could tell, he recalled. But part of me was still like, holy shoot, I'm in the studio singing with Brooks and Dunn. I was right there, right next to Ronnie. At one point, he even told me, stop singing so good. Pardee's new album, Heartache Medication, due out in late September, is full of that same kind of old-school country, accompanied by some modern influences for good measure. Hear John Pardee's latest album and its namesake single, and find out where to see him live by visiting johnpardee.com.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.